Welcome to Amici, news and insight from the New York Judiciary and the Unified Court System. I'm John Carr. On July 3, 1973, 45 years ago, the Court of Appeals issued two rather brief opinions, both per curiam, on separate issues of intense interest to the gay community. In application of Tom, the judges in Albany overturned the lower court and recognized Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund as a legitimate corporation entitled to practice law. In application of Kimball, the court reinstated the law license of a gay man who had been disbarred for committing an act, quote, contrary to the good morals, close quote, of the state of Florida. To the LGBTQ community, those decisions represented a small but vital stepping stone toward equality. And today, July 3, 1973, is viewed in that community as, quote, the day the Court of Appeals made pride possible in New York, close quote. The Richard C. Fallah LGBTQ Commission of the New York State Courts is presenting a Pride Month program on those decisions Tuesday, June 19th, in the rotunda of the Supreme Court facility at 60 Center Street in Manhattan. Matthew J. Skinner, Executive Director of the Commission, has graciously agreed to this podcast interview. Matt, welcome to Amici. First, the details on the June 19th program, if we could. Just a nutshell, who, what, when, where, why.
Yeah, so our program is at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday, June 19th at the 60 Center Street Courthouse in Manhattan. I always jokingly call 60 Center Street the Law and Order Courthouse, the courthouse where, you know, where they're always walking out on Law and Order after court.
Sure, the Mariska Hargitay program.
There's a big rotunda in 60 Center Street where there's a lot of ceremonial events as you right after you walk through security. So the event will be right in there. We've got a wide variety of speakers coming. William Tom, who was the founder of Lambda Legal and later became the first openly gay judge in New York, is sort of the highlight of the evening. And a lot of the event is going to be about you know, what he did, but we'll also have Judge Paul Feinman from the Court of Appeals, Judge Rosalind Richter from the Appellate Division First Department, retired Judge Michael Sonberg, and then Rachel Tiven from Lambda Legal and Arthur Leonard, professor from New York Law School.
Sounds like a good lineup. Now, you're going to be talking about, I guess, mainly two cases, two seminal Court of Appeals cases,
yeah.
almost exactly 45 years ago.
Right. We thought if they were decided on July 3rd, but we didn't think we could get much of a crowd out on July 3rd. So we're having it a couple weeks early, but it's just about 45 years.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Let's start with Tom. Very briefly, what was this case about, and what did the court say, and why does it matter?
So in the years after the Stonewall riots, which took place in 1969, you know, gay people in New York City started to form organizations to sort of work on fighting for equality and civil rights. One of those organizations that a group of lawyers, gay lawyers here in New York City, decided to form, inspired by organizations like the NAACP during the African American Civil Rights Movement, they thought that there should be a similar organization for gay people to also work on advancing their civil rights. And at the time, there was a sort of complicated process for formally incorporating as a legal assistance corporation in New York, and it involved getting approval of an application from various bar associations and then getting your sort of application approved by the Appellate Division First Department. So this small group of gay lawyers led by William Tom sort of looked at what the papers at the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund had filed to get their organization approved, and basically just changed the word Puerto Rican for homosexual, basically throughout their application. Mm. And so they got submitted all their papers to the Appellate Division, and unfortunately, the Appellate Division and a unanimous five-judge panel turned them down and said, you know, the buzzwords were benevolent and charitable, and they looked at the papers and said, on their face, this organization is neither benevolent nor charitable.
What were they concluding, that it was a lobbying organization or something?
Well, they really, you know, it came down to sort of, they said the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund, you know, talked about how so many folks in that community did not have the resources to obtain lawyers. And they felt, and strangely, they felt that there was no evidence of that for the gay community, at least in their eyes, that there was not really a need for this kind of organization in the same way that they thought that there was for other communities. And I think, you know, I was able to pull some of the papers from the record, thanks to the librarian at the Court of Appeals. I know you saw them too, John. I think they were sort of, they got some, the City Bar and NYCLA both ultimately said they supported the application, but they had some things in their letters to the appellate division that I think the appellate division sort of found and sort of, you know, used to write their opinion. And unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of guidance as to what benevolent or charitable meant. There were sort of ambiguous regulations here, and they, for whatever reason, just sort of felt like, you know, there wasn't, they didn't see the evidence before them that the organization was necessary.
let's back up a second. Do you know if the NAACP faced similar problems when they were getting incorporated?
You know, I don't know. I don't think they were formally incorporated here in New York. I think they may have started in another, although I don't know this off the top of my head. But I do know later when this got to the Court of Appeals, the concurrence by Court of Appeals Judge Adrian Burke, which was joined by Stanley Fold, he wrote a lengthy concurring opinion citing a couple of Supreme Court cases, one of which involved the NAACP, and he really talked about the sort of First Amendment implications of, you know, just denying Lambda Legal incorporation here. And this, there had sort of been a lot of games played in a couple southern states when the NAACP would try to start a chapter or whatever, and they were rules were suddenly drawn up to sort of thwart them from doing that. But and eventually, the Supreme Court had said, you know, there's major First Amendment implications from denying someone, an organization like the NAACP, from forming a chapter in a state, and they're, you know, other sort of considerations just cannot outweigh the sort of First Amendment rights of a private organization like the NAACP and now Lambda Legal from forming.
What does Lambda mean? What does that word mean?
You know, it's an interesting ancient Greek, I believe it was an ancient Greek letter in their language, and it came to have sort of a special meaning to the gay community. I think another reason they chose this sort of this name was because they were trying not to put the word gay in their name. They didn't want, you know, they were trying to, and this, I've heard this from other folks that started gay organizations in the 70s, that there was a lot of, you know, a lot of people were just scared of being involved with an organization that would have, you know, the word gay in its name. And so there was sort of, you know, sort of a way to, you know, start an organization that wouldn't immediately scare off a lot of people that you were hoping to become supporters.
Okay. Yeah. So the court, in an unsigned opinion,
right,
sides with Lambda.
Yeah.
And we've got a couple of our concurrence by, was it by Adrian Burke or by Stanley Fold?
Burke wrote it and Fold joined it.
Okay.
And they really did a much further analysis. And I know when I sat down and had lunch with Bill Tom a few weeks ago, he was telling me he thinks that the concurrence was originally the majority opinion. And then they may have lost some judges along the way. They couldn't get to for whatever reason. But originally, they were hoping, and the lawyer that had helped Bill Thom take this to the Court of Appeals, they were hoping to get these sort of regulations for forming these organizations just completely struck down altogether. And it looks like, had the concurrence been the sort of majority opinion, they may have gotten there. But unfortunately, or for better or for worse, Judge Burr could not get four judges to join the opinion. And so that became just a concurrence, and the brief sort of reversal, which was just a few sentences long, became the sort of majority opinion, if you will.
Mm-hmm, I see. Now, what about Kimball? What was that all about?
So Kimball, Harris Kimball was originally admitted to the Florida bar in 1953, and he had established a law practice there. In 1955, he was sort of accused of engaging in oral sex with another man in Orlando, which at the time was violated a city ordinance concerning sodomy. So he was arrested, released on bond. He forfeited the bond, which he claimed was equivalent under local law to a plea of nolo contendere. The Florida bar conducted a hearing at which the police officers, the other participant in the beach incident, or the incident where he got arrested, Kimball and his witnesses testified. The Florida bar was satisfied that there was cause to initiate a formal disbarment proceeding. And so Kimball represented himself before a referee. There were several sessions, and eventually the referee found that Kimball had committed an act contrary to the good morals and the law of the state and recommended disbarment. The Florida Bar Board of Governors concurred with the referee. They referred the matter to the Florida Supreme Court. At that point, Kimball did not argue any further, and the Supreme Court adopted the report and ordered Kimball disbarred.
Was the issue that he had engaged in sodomy, or the issue that he did it in public?
Both. I mean, sodomy was illegal no matter where you did it, but he was found on a beach.
Okay, so no matter where it occurred, it would have been a crime under Florida law at the time.
Yeah, and I believe this was 1955, it was illegal in all 50 states at that point. Anyway, he eventually left Florida, did some other things, but over the next few years, actually there was an effort started to repealing these sodomy statutes, and the Model Penal Code actually that came out later from the American Law Institute recommended a repeal of these sodomy statutes. And there was, I think, maybe just a small handful of states at that point had started to repeal the statutes by 1972, 1973. New York had not been one of them. So anyway, Kimball eventually moved to New York. He sort of got caught up in the sort of growing gay rights movement at the time, and he decided to try to become a lawyer again. So he applied for admission to the New York bar in 1972. He took and passed the bar exam. He received a favorable report from the Committee on Character and Fitness for the Appellate Division Second Department. The Character Committee unfortunately felt stymied by an old New York Court of Appeals decision that was titled In Re Peters, which the committee felt precluded a positive recommendation until Kimball could get himself readmitted to the Florida bar. So the committee issued its report without having made a recommendation and referred Kimball's application to the justices of the Appellate Division Second Department in Brooklyn. And then a five-judge panel voted 3-2 to deny the application in a per curiam opinion dated January 3rd, 1973. All five judges agreed that the Character Committee had misconstrued the Peters precedent, since that case had concerned really specific facts. And although the Florida disbarment and the incidents that led up to it were facts to be considered, it was up to the New York court to differently as to his fitness to practice law. But the majority in the dissents diverged pretty sharply. The majority rejected Kimball's argument that the Florida Supreme Court decision finding the sodomy law of that state unconstitutionally vague, which had happened since his arrest and the incidents following his arrest. And they didn't think that made that disbarment now irrelevant to his New York bar application. Furthermore, they said, this is still a felony in New York at the time of Kimball's Florida disbarment. So had Kimball committed the offense in New York, he would have been subject to automatic disbarment, and later changes to the law didn't detract from the validity of the original disbarment proceeding. They said, moreover, we cannot overlook as trifling the conduct of the applicant in attempting to mislead the authorities in Florida by giving false testimony in the disbarment proceedings. The majority also found implicit in his application the idea that social change in the intervening years justified overlooking his Florida bar history and, a fresh look. The majority sort of rejected this approach and remarked that so long as sodomy remained a crime in New York, homosexuality, which in its fulfillment usually entails commission of such a statutorily prescribed act, is a factor which could militate against the eligibility of an applicant for admission to the bar who proposes to pursue this way of life in disregard of the statute. The dissenters, and ultimately the dissenting opinion was adopted by the Court of Appeals, they said, the character committee had unanimously found that Kimball otherwise had the character and fitness required for admission to the bar. They didn't agree with the majority that the old Florida disbarment should stand in the way. Let's see, one more. There was a good quote here. And they say, to us, it seems clear that the social and moral climate in New York has in recent years changed dramatically with respect to homosexuality and consensual homosexual acts. In our opinion, an applicant for admission to the bar in New York in 1972 cannot be considered unfit or lacking the requisite character to practice law merely because he is an avowed homosexual, and we agree with the character committee's finding that this applicant is fit for admission. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the 3-2 split on the appellate division in Brooklyn. There was a lot of fear within the gay community at the time. They were sort of alarmed by the dicta by the appellate division majority, which sort of implied that openly gay people would be could be considered unfit to practice law in New York.
Almost inherently.
Yeah. So they, they wanted to appeal this, and they got up to the, and because I think it was 3-2, you get an automatic right of appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, it kind of would have been more interesting if the court granted leave.
Right. And then anyway, and as you mentioned, this was another really brief per curiam opinion by the Court of Appeals, and it appeared to be 6-1. There was just a short quote here. While Kimball's conduct may be now and has been in the past violative of accepted norms, they are not controlling, albeit relevant, in assessing character bearing on the right to practice law in this state. Notably, the Committee on Character and Fitness found appellant to be of good character and qualified at this time. And then they, they note their agreement with the dissent that I spoke about just a minute ago. Judge Gabrielli, Dominic Gabrielli, really focused on the fact that we still had, enforced, a sodomy statute in New York that could be enforced, and the fact that he, acknowledged that, he was an openly gay individual. Sort of, Gabrielli said, the appellate division has full and complete authority to deny admission to the bar to one who is an avowed and admitted persistent violator of any criminal statute. So he really, did not think they could just overlook the fact that this sort of activity was still, a criminal offense in New York. New York.
I guess the question wasn't exactly before them, but it would have been interesting to see if the court at that time had taken up the question of whether the sodomy statute was constitutional.
Right. And they would do that 7 years later and strike it down in a case called a no fray.
Hmm. I'm a little surprised it was only 7 years later.
Right.
And at the same time, I'm surprised it wasn't 50 years earlier, but you know what I mean.
But the thing was, too, what made it possible for the lawyers to sort of get organized enough to have that fight in the court system was really these two decisions, because you couldn't, Lambda Legal, if you couldn't even form an organization to sort of fight for justice within the courts, getting a decision like that is much more difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Also, many of the lawyers that would be involved in the eventual fight to get the sodomy statute declared unconstitutional, wouldn't have been able to be open about their sexual orientation had we not really had this Kimball decision from the Court of Appeals that made that clear. So it's interesting how these little, these little opinions that were just a couple sentences long really did a lot more than is just on the surface. They really made it possible for the gay legal community at the time to get organized and be open about their sexual orientation and do come back and have the fights that would come later for full sort of equality under the law.
I guess there's no way to tell, but I wonder if the Court of Appeals at that time realized that they were changing the course of the ship.
Right. No, I mean, I think, it's so interesting to me, too, that these decisions came out on the same day. Sort of like a double whammy here in terms of sort of injecting some lifeblood into the small but growing movement at the time. They must have been on some level aware of that, and it may not have been entirely clear to them what they were doing or what this would lead to, but I think the small decision to put them out on the same day was also very interesting to me.
In my experience, that does not happen accidentally.
Right.
Now, do you think at the time the gay community really appreciated how important this was?
Yeah, I mean, I think they were really, as I mentioned when I was talking about Kimball, I think there was a lot of fear by the lawyers that were sort of involved with Lambda Legal. One of the folks who was one of, there were three people listed on the incorporation papers for Lambda Legal, and one of those individuals, his name was Kerry Bogan. He wrote an amicus brief for Harris Kimball at the Court of Appeals, it was just, it's wild to me how far ahead of his time he was and some of the arguments that he was making.
On the other hand, there is a certain risk, a certain danger in going to the Court of Appeals with these cases, because a loss could have set things back a generation.
And I had said to Bill Tom when I had lunch with him a couple of weeks ago, did you have a backup plan if you didn't get the appellate division reversed here? And he said, no. He said, everyone, we were working with at the time, was in New York. We wanted this to be a New York organization, and it would have been just really sort of strange to, incorporate it in another state. So he said there was no sort of backup plan if they lost at the Court of Appeals. For better or for worse, there's always been, depending on when you want to start considering when gay history started, but there's just, a big gay population in New York City, and it really would have, been devastating if those individuals couldn't start their own organizations or openly practice law. It would have been a real, as you said, a real setback. That, and of course, I don't think people would have just totally given up and gone home. But it could have greatly, affected how things played out.
Certainly, I was doing some reading recently on Thurgood Marshall and how cautious he was in not going to the Supreme Court with a case unless he was very, very confident he could win.
Right.
And imagine if the court had gone the other way in Brown v. Board of Education.
Yeah, now I know, and I mean, I know they they had a re-argument in that case, right? There was, you know, I think from my own memory of reading some books on the whole saga of Brown v. Board at the Supreme Court, there was a lot of things, you know, happening in conference, and trying to make it a unanimous decision was not easy, and a lot of things happening behind the scenes. Had things gone differently, it just would have, you know, changed the course of history.
and like the decisions, you know, we're talking about today, Brown v. Board of Education was, I believe it was a per curiam, and it was also short. I mean, it's only 12 pages, and for a Supreme Court decision, that's real short.
Right. You know?
Anyhow, I think we've covered the past. Let's move on to the future. So June 19th, what are we going to see? Who's going to be speaking?
Yeah, we said that at the beginning. Do you want me to say it again?
Sure. Okay. If you could repeat that for me, please.
Yeah, so Roz Richter, Justice Roz Richter, who is now on the Associate Justice at the Appellate Division First Department, she actually worked at Lambda Legal in the early years. She was one of their first sort of employees. The first few years, they really just were operating out of Bill Thom's apartment, and they had no staff for a number of years. It was all just sort of pro bono volunteers, writing amicus briefs and helping people where they could. They did not have a lot of infrastructure. So Justice Richter is going to speak about what it was like to work there in the earlier days. And ironically, she later became the first openly gay judge at the Appellate Division First Department. So it's sort of an irony of history that, one of the, early after the Appellate Division turned down this application, Judge Richter would later work there and then, eventually work at the First Department herself. Judge Feinman is going to talk about some more sort of gay history, gay rights history at the Court of Appeals. Arthur Leonard, who is the Robert F. Wagner Professor of Labor and Employment Law at New York Law School, is going to tell us more about the history of the Kimball decision, and he would later found it's gone through a few names, but what we now call the LGBT Bar Association of Greater New York. He would later found that bar association in 1978, and he's told me about how, really the Kimball decision made it possible for, a bar association like that to exist. The other sort of interesting piece of this story is that Bill Thom would later also become the first openly gay judge at any level in New York in 1984 after an appointment from Mayor Koch, Ed Koch. And Michael Sonberg, the retired, he recently retired in December from the bench here in New York City, but he's sort of the unofficial historian of the LGBT judicial community here in New York, and he's going to talk about Bill Thom's sort of role in sort of gay judicial history later on in his life. So that's sort of the lineup. We'll also have the current CEO of Lambda Legal, who we'll talk about how sort of the spirit of the early founders. And the spirit of the decision from the Court of Appeals that they had to be allowed to incorporate sort of still lives on within the organization.
Sounds like a great event. What does it cost to get in?
It's going
to
be free.
Wow! So, and if somebody wants to attend, whether they just show up?
Yes, exactly. So you should maybe just get there. There is because you're entering a courthouse, there is a little security to go through. So perhaps folks would arrive a little bit early just to get through security. But other than that, everyone is welcome to join us for free.
That sounds like a terrific program. Thanks so much for your time, Matt.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Amici. You find all of our recent podcasts on the court system's website at www.nycourts.gov. And most are also in the iTunes podcast library. If you have a suggestion for an Amici podcast, please let me know. I'm John Carl, and I can be reached at 518-453-8669 or jcaher@nycourts.gov. In the meantime, stay tuned.